I've been fostering these relationships with Sephora, with understanding what was going on for such a long time. But at the same time, I will say that I feel like I've had an easier time than some other people do because I've created community, relationship, and I've learned things along the way. I think the world changes so fast that you don't know what you don't know, but at least if you have relationships, you can ask people and you can understand. And ultimately, I feel like if you're smart enough, there's like a baseline, right? But like, really all of us are smart enough. It's just having the curiosity and the want to learn and then connecting the dots so that you can figure things out.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earn. Today, I've got Amy Liu, the founder and CEO of Tower 28 on the show. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I must say, I was saying this before the call, but your numbers as a brand are super impressive. It must be fun to see the brand really come to life the way that it has over the last couple of years.
Over the last couple of years, but I would say this year in particular has been an exceptional year. Our sales are roughly three times what they were last year.
Wow. Okay. That lines up. You ever seen your EMV up about 100% year over year, which is really tough to do. Well, let's talk about that for a minute then. So I'm a big believer that the results that you're seeing today are really the result of work you did, call it 2 years ago, 3 years ago, rather than what you did last quarter. So if you were to think about the decisions that you were making 2 to 3 years ago that led to that success today, what would be some of those decisions?
One thing I really believe in is I think you really earn your reputation, and I really believe in investing in relationships. So whether we're talking about Sephora and our relationship with them, which we have an exclusive partnership with Sephora, we're in every Sephora US and Canada. And I think being in an exclusive partnership with them has been really good for us and for them, I hope. And so I think whether it's that or it's the influencer community that we're talking about or my team, frankly, I think it's really just investing in people. People, and I would also say products. So at the end of the day, at a very base level, like I came into this with experience from a corporate side, but I am not in any way an influencer. I don't have that form of influence. Like even now, I would say I almost never post personally. I don't really show up a lot in our current content. And so that was never really part of our positioning in that way. So for us, it's really like we just have to make really good products. I believe very deeply that you have to earn people's money and their trust, and people vote with their wallets. And so from the very beginning, I was like, we have to have good products. Not that anybody else wants to have bad products, right? But I think early on, people said to me things like, oh, product, you just need it to be like 70% of the rest of its marketing. And like, nothing irks me more than when specifically product developers tell me that, because I'm like, just, I want it to be amazing. I feel like I've invested ahead in certain ways. And in other ways, I probably need to start investing more.
What are the other ways you need to start investing more?
I mean, frankly, we haven't done much in the way of paid influencer, right? So I also really believe that people deserve to be paid when they're doing work. So the only thing we have paid people, but for like specific UGC, if we're trying to use it to put it on our P page, but we have not done influencer deals or things like that. We've paid like a celebrity makeup artist. We'll pay to do shade development, those types of things. But we certainly don't have like an ongoing program. I've asked you so many times. We haven't had like a person in that seat that really could just do the whole suite of things. And so now we just hired someone, hoping we're able to start leaning into it a little more.
So what has the program looked like up until this point then, if it hasn't been on the paid side?
I think the technical term is what, spray and pray? Is that what they call it?
With the help of tribes
so that we're trying to do it a little more strategically. I think we are trying to make really great products.
Yeah.
Offer them to people who show an interest in them and basically be in the game of being nice, which is whether we're restocking, we're engaging with them, we're taking them to lunch, and we're just being nice. But doing it hopefully really authentically. I think like anything else, I don't continue relationships with people unless I really feel like we have an affinity towards each other.
So one of the things that you mentioned, I think is really important, you said a few times in terms of product quality and having really good products. I think the best way I've heard that described was by Ian Rogers. So he was the chief digital officer at LVMH. Prior to that, he was the CTO at Beats when they sold for $1 billion. He called it the hyper-efficiency of quality. This idea of the hyper-efficiency of quality is basically like, if you have something that's really, really good today, the likelihood that that grows has increased, right? Because there's more access to information. There's more people to talk about it. And I think, you know, if you were to look back, say 20, 30 years, if you were a brand, you had a lot of paid media budget, you had retail distribution, you could actually generate a lot of revenue with a fairly mediocre product. And I think today, because there is so many more brands, there's so many more products, and there's so much more access to information.
So much more noise.
Yeah. The quality of that product ends up mattering a lot more in terms of how it performs overall.
100%. And I just think that customers have all of the power. There are so many choices that they get to make. So I really do think you have to earn that trust.
Well, let's get into influencers more later. I do want people to get to know you, right? So I think that, you know, a big part of why I do these is I think for a lot of people, they look at where you've gotten to and they say, oh, I want to get there. That's something that I aspire to do. And so taking a step back in your career, let's go way back. You're 23. You're laid off from Accenture during the 2000 crisis when a lot of people were getting laid off. I'd love to know what that period of time was like in your life. And then if it did, how that shaped your approach to maybe life, career, et cetera.
I actually consider that such a gift, even though at that time, I'm sure it felt really hard. So I think I had a really linear trajectory from a very early on time because, you know, my parents are immigrants. They immigrated from Taiwan. Education was very important to them. Going to college was never a question. It was more of a which one. And then it was like after college, then you get the best job you can. For me, it happened to be Accenture, which was one of the big five consulting firms. And I think I had a lot of my identity wrapped in like this trajectory that I was on. And so when I got laid off, it kind of threw me into a little bit of a tailspin, but then also made me think, what do I actually want to do with my life? And I wasn't sure. I literally went to business school. So I went to USC for business school. And the intention was to figure out what I wanted to do because I worked at Accenture, but I didn't actually love the work. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I was doing computer programming.
Oh.
I was a systems analyst. I was a process systems analyst. So I was doing like integration of basically like ERP type things. And it was not really what I wanted to do. And I started reading all those, I don't know, these books like What Should I Do With My Life? And What Color Is Your Parachute? I don't know if you ever read any of those things. But I was like, what do I really want to do? I want to do something that I could see myself in so I could understand the customer. I really loved reading magazines. I was kind of a girly girl. And I started thinking about beauty. And so I'm actually really grateful for that because I think so much of life is like it has a momentum to it. So I was doing well at Accenture. The reason I was laid off was because it was 2000. There was so much like, what's going on with like all of this? And so I could imagine how if you get into something, even if you don't like it that much, but the world is telling you you're good at it, you just keep going. And for me, I was really glad that I had that forced break where I had to switch gears. And I've worked in beauty ever since then. So that was 20 years ago. And I'm really grateful for that transition.
You know, it's funny that you say that because when I was graduating college, it was 2009. So it was right after the great financial crisis. I was graduating with like a degree in like finance and economics and whatever, and probably would have gone that route. But it was just like nobody was hiring at that time. Like 2009, nobody in those industries was hiring. And so I ended up getting a few job offers. But one of the things I took that I definitely wouldn't have taken, I took an internship at a startup company because I was like, hey, I'll go work there for a month or two until like I go take this other job. I was going to go work in Wells Fargo's finance division or whatever. And then ended up working there and was like, oh, this is really cool. It's a startup. It's growing really fast. It's really exciting. And ended up taking that career path. And it probably wouldn't have happened without the recession, which felt like a really bad thing at the time. And ultimately, I would have probably not ended up starting a company. And so really interesting. I never thought about it that way.
I think there's like these like weird, like defining moments in life where you can kind of go left or right. And you can either see it as like a negative thing sometimes. So like, you know, I've quit my job before. I've done things in my career, which in hindsight, it all makes sense. But at the time, it feels really hard and stressful.
Yeah. 100%.
Because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. You don't have a thing on the other side. I'm curious. I know another moment in time for you with that was deciding to take some time off, right? So you've got three kids and you decide to take some time off, which I think is like a very stressful decision as a working mom, right? Because you don't want to leave your career behind. You don't want to leave all the progress you made behind.
I'm actually so glad you're asking me about this because it's something I feel like people should talk about more.
Yeah.
It is really hard to be a working mom, especially when you're in. So just to pull it back to that moment, I was a head of marketing at Josie Maran at the time. And in the 3 years that I worked there, I was the first executive on the team, the first VP, and we had gone from like 9 million to like 50 million over the course of like 3 years.
Yeah.
So to say it was busy, I mean, I was like, it actually gave me a lot of confidence in the sense where I was like, wait, I was so close to it that I was like, wait, maybe I can do this myself, which is a different part of it. But it was also so busy. And at that same time, I had two small children.
Yeah.
And I think to have small children, to be in a dual income family, and it's hard, it's expensive. One, childcare is not cheap.
Yeah.
And then to be like working, coming home, I would put the kids down and then I would work again. And that was just my routine. And on top of that, I just found myself really unhappy. Mm-hmm. And so the truth is I like was unhappy, but I didn't tell my husband about it because, you know, when you're really unhappy, sometimes you're so busy, you just keep going.
Yeah.
And then at some point I just told him, and I actually really am so grateful to him because I think this is the greatest gift he's ever given me. He said, he was like, why don't you quit? And I was like, what do you mean? I don't have another job. I can quit. And he was like, no, why don't, he's like, the whole reason we've saved money, and he's a really frugal guy. And by the way, he's now my CFO. So it's good that he's frugal. But he was like, why don't you just quit and like figure it out? Like, let's just reset. And I didn't waste any time. I literally walked in the next day, put in my notice. And at the time, it seems almost silly to say this, like quitting a job is scary, but like it was the scariest thing I'd ever done because I was really career focused and I had invested so much in my career and it was part of my identity. And specifically, beauty was this thing that only thing I had ever done. And I was really afraid that I wouldn't be able to get back in. And so if I could give anybody advice that happens to be listening to this and wants to do the same thing, I would say the thing that I did that was helpful is I kept my toe in the water. So I didn't just leave mm-hmm. the industry. I kept consulting and I worked for, I don't know, Lime Crime, Marula, Jouer. Like I worked for these other brands in different capacities. So I could at least stay smart. I could be part of it still. I knew what was going on. I knew I always wanted to get back into when my younger daughter started preschool. I was like, I have always wanted to go back to work. And that's when I started Tower 28. But during that time, I wish I would have just enjoyed it more. Like if somebody had told me then that this was going to happen, I would have like really enjoyed that time. But I feel like I wasted so much energy being worried about what was going to come next and would I be able to do it. That
it's one of the great challenges in life, right? Because some of that worry, some of that stress is why you were successful. That's the double-edged sword there. It's like, if you take away that edge, would you have even made it? I don't know, right? Like it's hard to know.
No, I had something to prove too. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there was a part of it where, I mean, and by the way, part of the reason I went to business school was because I had always wanted to do my own thing. The reason I went to go work for other founders was because I wanted to learn on someone else's dime. I wanted to see how the sausage was made, like, and get a closer look at it. And then all of a sudden, I was 39 turning 40 when I raised money to start Tower 28. And I remember it was right before I was 40 because my friend, my lead investor was like, you are not getting any younger. Because I just invited him to my 40th birthday party. And he was like, you're really not getting any younger. If you don't do it now, you'll just never do it. And I was like, oh shit, he's right, you know? Also to say though that like, and I feel like I'm older compared to a lot of founders that I know. But like, I don't in any way regret doing it when I did it. I'm so happy. I feel like I've been really fortunate. I've had the chance to work for other people, learn on someone else's dime. And even taking that time out, it's not like I did it and I didn't get to also have my family, right? Like I was able to have those years raising my children, being really close to them, working part-time in a totally different capacity. And now I get to do this where like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm friends with some founders who will say, I'm just freezing my eggs because I'm so focused right now. And like later, I'll do it later. And I'm like, okay, or you can do it all now. You'll be okay. You know,
it can be done. Yeah. I think taking those breaks, I'm a huge advocate of them as well. Like I took 7 months off after my last company I was at just to travel, you know, with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. And like that ended up leading to starting Tribe, was like the things that we learned during that part of the journey. And my father-in-law is also a big advocate of that. He's taken 3 or 4 6 to 12 month breaks over the period of time, spends a lot of time with family, part-time consulting. Like, it's great.
Yeah. I think it can be scary, but I think it's so healthy at the same time, especially if you're like, I'm a fairly hardworking person too. It's hard for me to do things a little bit. And so I think I'm the type of person who it's hard to just coast. So I'd rather just like do anything a little bit more clearly.
Yeah. Would you, if you could go back, would you have started a brand earlier?
I mean, it's hard to rewrite history because people all the time say things to me like, oh, it's like an overnight success. And I'm like, I don't feel like it's an overnight success. I've been working in this industry for 20 years.
Yeah.
I've been fostering these relationships with Sephora, with understanding what was going on for such a long time. But at the same time, I will say that I feel like I've had an easier time than some other people do because I've created community relationship and I've learned things along the way. I think the world changes so fast that you don't know what you don't know, but at least if you have relationships, you can ask people and you can understand. And ultimately, I feel like if you're smart enough, there's like a baseline, right? But like really all of us are smart enough. It's just having the curiosity and the want to learn and then connecting the dots so that you can figure things out. I think that's a huge part of it, but I don't regret doing it. I feel like specifically in our society, we make it so sexy and glamorized to have success at a really young age.
Yep.
When I see people are like, oh, 30 under 30, to me, I'm glad it happened when it did, because I feel like having been a manager made me a better boss today. You know what I mean? Because I feel like I understand what it's like to work for a founder. And I'm not saying I'm not a little crazy. I think all founders are a little crazy, but I'd like to think I'm just slightly less crazy.
I will tell you, we had a lot of crazy early on. We were rethinking a lot of things that did not need to be rethought. We're rethinking like forecast. Like, we don't believe in forecasting. Our other board member, who's a CFO, was like, what do you mean? We're like, Warren Buffett says forecasts don't matter and that nobody knows what they're doing. And so we're not going to do it. He's like, okay, interesting. But you can try. I was like, oh, you know, that's a decision you make when you're 26, not 36.
And that's your point. It's like part of that is the benefit I've had is I've seen things go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I've had a little bit more, I don't know, like the stress of it all, I think is mildly more manageable because I can kind of level set like how big of a deal it is.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, when we started the company, I was 24 and it's like, I look at 24-year-olds now, I'm like, you should not start a company. And I don't think I'm like a special flower. Like, I think that we learned a lot of things the hard way. I like to say that we were successful due to effort, not intelligence.
I always say I think people should learn on someone else's dime first.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we did it for a couple of years, not long enough, I think.
You've had a great outcome. So I don't know that you would rewrite history. There's no right or wrong to it, right?
Yeah, 100%. So one of the other things I've thought a lot about, just this is more like a personal question, like I've done a lot of guest lecturing and whatever at universities. I know you did a bit of teaching, right? So you were teaching at FITM for a while, like 6 years.
Yeah.
What made you decide to do that? And then I know separately, you run this beauty school program for up and coming founders, which like you said, you've got kids, you got your current company, like you got a lot going on. So like, it was like, that's not something that drives direct benefit to you. So I'm curious what motivated you to do that as well.
So there is the altruistic part of it, which I very much believe in, which is I really do think that if I can help other people on their journey, whether it is through learning from my mistakes, and specifically, like you mentioned, Clean Beauty Summer School, that is very close to me because I think growing up in the industry, I just didn't see myself, whether you're talking about within the actual corporate structure, like seeing people in leadership that were one, women, especially back then, and two, people of color. I didn't see it. But then even in the images of aspiration that were reflected from this industry, I didn't see myself. So at a young age, growing up in LA, I just didn't feel like I was in the heart of entertainment and all these types of things. And I just didn't see myself in it. And I feel like that does something to you where you just don't feel like you are not the ideal. You're not the aspiration. And I think that the way that that changes is by putting people in the seats where they're actually picking the pictures that represent themselves and aspiration and what they see in the world. So the diversity part of it truly is important to me because I do think it's the way that this industry actually ends up evolving. And I am very truly aware of the fact that I was able to attend a four-year college. I went to business school. I've had good jobs. I had a lot of privilege that made that possible for me. And so I think if I can like share that with other people and just provide the mentorship, you would agree too, I'm sure, but beauty is a really small industry. And so I think it's hard to break into sometimes and certainly hard to access the information. Although I would also argue the barrier to entry is quite low today.
Yep.
But if we can help people get there faster or have more resources to do it, I'm really happy to do it. The other side of it is, I don't know, it makes me feel good. I enjoy it. To teach a class, I think there's something about it that one really reinforces the information for yourself because you have to think through it and you have to be like, what is actually the most important thing here? And so I think you actually learn a lot through teaching. And then I also get to sit in on the classes of all the other people who teach, like when you teach, Connor, like I feel like I learn something every time. It's kind of a selfish thing in some sense that I get a benefit from on a personal level. And then it's also just a reflection, I think, of my community. It's a nice way for me to continue to be in community with whether it is early founders, people like you, et cetera. So I don't know. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I think like you said earlier, in terms of these relationships and how much you value those relationships, I think that investing in other people and helping them be successful, particularly when you're in a position to do that effectively, you know, just creates, and especially when they have nothing to give back, right? Like there's no direct way to drive value. It's just really powerful, right? It's a really powerful thing to do, an important thing to do. And frankly, does end up, I think, in the long run, building that reputation you talked about and building that community of people that want to support you and you want to support them. And so,
I mean, the most fun part to me about doing what we do, and I know that you have a pretty broad network in beauty too, is having done it for this long, I think it's super fun that it's like the sorority of my adult life, to be honest with you,
right? Like, totally.
Like, I feel like when I go to Sephora, I'm like, oh, I'm so happy for Diana from Crown Affair that she got an end cap, or I'm so happy, you know, like I can see it and I can celebrate it. But even on the other side of things, when we went into Sephora for the first time, it was because Avril, who was, she was like the coordinator, like the assistant merchant, like a junior person when I was at Josie.
Yeah.
And she had risen up the ranks and become the director. I think it's so fun to watch people grow up in the industry and do really well. And you're like, that's so cool. Look at you. Like, Carolyn Bojanowski was my e-com merchant, who's now the head of merchandising at Sephora. And you meet each other at different points and then you see each other do really well. And I think that's really fun.
Now, it's funny. I feel like the beauty industry is much more communal than a lot of other industries for whatever reason. I don't know what that is, but it's like much more collaborative, even when you might be slightly
competitive. It is now. I think back in the day, it wasn't.
You know, maybe we're, you know, this next generation's the one making it more communal.
Next gen. Right?
This is actually, I think, a really important topic. So this idea that teaching forces you to really distill down the learnings, I think is critical as well. Like for me, I started publishing whatever, 7-8 months ago on like Twitter and LinkedIn. I was like, I'm going to start sharing, like, we're in this business. We should also participate, right? Like we should do this. And it was like a challenge at first because like, oh, I know how to talk about this, but how do I visually convey that? How do I convey this in a written way, in a way that people are going to understand and for an audience that I can't go back and forth with? And it was just really powerful in terms of forcing me to put it on paper and to share it that way, share the learnings that I've had over the last, whatever, 12 years. It's really cool in that way. That's a big part of the value of doing it. So let's talk about influencers for a second, right? That's the business that we're in, obviously, and you are killing it. So I mentioned the numbers earlier, but first half of the year, you're up 96% year over year. You are our number 67th ranked brand last year in that period. You're number 37 this year. You passed brands like Glossier, Revlon, like big players. A few questions here. One, Let's talk about it at the beginning. So you talked about this a little bit earlier, but I know like you started out like, hey, we're going to just send a box to 200 influencers. What were the earliest days of that program outside of the spray and pray? Like what were some of the specific things that you were doing to like get it off the ground if somebody's just starting?
We definitely have gifted. You know, I always think of these things like any other sales funnel. So you want to send products to people who you actually feel like might be interested in your products.
Yep.
So whether they're saying things because, so our products are designed for sensitive skin, made for all. We're the only beauty brand that is 100% compliant with the National Eczema Association. And so very early on, we were looking for signals of people who were saying that they had an issue that we could help solve with our, like our SOS spray or whatever it was. And so I think there is a part of it where you have to do a certain amount of like stalking, for lack of a better word, right? Like you want to give them a product that actually meets their needs. And then I think it's just telling them. So like, hey, I noticed that you were having an issue with eczema. I would love to send you this product for you to try. It's made a huge difference for me. Can I get your mailing address?
Yep.
I think that that step of just being a little bit more personal, whether it is like, I still really believe in writing a handwritten note.
Yeah, totally.
Which is, my team hates me for that too, but I'm also happy to write a lot of the notes. So I feel like at least I'm not a total hypocrite on it, but I think it's really important. Influencers, people get so much product today that there has to be a reason to open it. It has to be thoughtful. So I've always said, I think other people can outspend us, but we can be thoughtful and we can be clever. Like those are things that don't necessarily cost a lot of money to do. And I think the other thing we really do is I try to really think about the concentric circles of it. For instance, really early on, one of the girls on my team was like, I would love for Patrick Ta to try our products. And I was like, okay, well, we could try, but like, who does Patrick Ta pay attention to? And we gifted Carly Fisher because Carly Fisher used to assist him. And we know that, you know what I mean?
Totally.
And so we do little things like that. I had a founder not too long ago, actually, who was like, can you just give me your list? Give me your list of like however many people and addresses and just save me the time so that I can take your list and send them all this product. And I was like, I could, but I don't actually think it's that valuable.
Yeah.
I think what's valuable is you have to develop the credibility and the relationship with those people so that when they get that box, they're actually excited to open it. If you just blind send people, one, I think it makes them kind of angry because they're like, how did you get my address?
Yep.
I wouldn't do it for privacy reasons, for one. But like, even if I just gave people handles, I also don't think that that's that helpful because you need to be the one who's initiating that relationship. So yes, I think early on we did the thoughtful side of things where we really were like, okay, well, why would this person care about our products?
Yeah, it's really fun for me when I hear people describe concepts that I've seen analytically, like I've seen in the data. And then like as an example, the Patrick Ta one. So people assume that it goes top down and it actually goes bottom up. Because what happens, totally, right, is every influencer has an Instagram feed that they go through. And when they see three or four of their friends talking about a brand, they're like, oh, maybe I should try that out. So the number for someone with over 1 million fans is about 5 or 6 people. 6 people in their network to talk about something before they'll talk about it on average. This is a bunch of stuff in there that you said that's like, yes, yes, yes.
It's funny because like early on, people would say things like, everybody loves your products. And I knew, actually, we just attacked this one little circle and all of you are friends with each other. And so you all think that we're really big, but like, it's only this one little corner of the internet.
Totally,
you
know what I mean?
And by the way, I should have finished the conversation. When I met Patrick Ta for the first time, he was like, Carly Fisher loves your products. And I was like, it worked.
Totally, totally. Long-term relationships, right? Our data gets featured in CEW and Women's Wear and Business of Fashion and Forbes and all these different places. And it's like, we built relationships with those teams over 10 years. Like it didn't happen over one quarter, right?
Yeah.
And that's generally, if you look at the numbers, how influencer relationships evolve. It's like a multi-year process that occurs. And so it's not just about sending the products out. That's not really the point. If you had any predictions in terms of how you think that space will evolve, call it over the next 3 to 5 years, do you think it's going to be more of the same? Are you seeing anything in terms of the behavior and the relationships that's different? Talk about that.
I think influencer will become even more important in the future. I think the fact that there is a strike going on and that content in general is just going to be less available to people, that they will have to look for content in different ways. But then I think it's also going to start to get more narrow in terms of the content that we view. It'll start just becoming more and more niche. But I do think that, I mean, if you even look at what happened in China, right? Like how many people are key opinion leaders? Like there just are so, so many of them. And we're all just trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to find people whose opinions we trust. And we're trying to learn and we're trying to be entertained, right? So it's like whether you're able to get it from Netflix and Hulu, but if you can't do that anymore, then you're going to try to get it from social.
I think being in the media business is a difficult proposition. And I think if you just monitor your own media consumption habits, like you'll see it. It's like for me, I used to watch SportsCenter and then I went from SportsCenter to, okay, now I listen to a podcast that's on the NFL because I really care about the NFL. To most recently, I now listen to a podcast that's about the Detroit Lions, which are my favorite team within the NFL, right? And so I've like gone down this chain of specificity to more and more specific interests. And I think that's describing exactly what's happened with what you're talking about. Well, let's do one kind of fun end of show question. So you wrote a letter to your younger self, which I recommend everybody read. I thought it was great. I really liked it. one of the lines you said in there that I thought was really fun was you said, basically like stick it out, and that your husband very specifically said that he would never get married. So I'm curious, that's got to be your greatest sale of all time. What was your pitch? How did you talk him into it?
So for context, my husband and I met when I was in college and I dated for 7 years before we got engaged, 8 until we got married. And we've now been together for 23 years and married for 15. So 9 months ago, he started working for me and today he's our CFO. So like, I'm a committed kind of girl, right? Like we have 3 kids together. We have a dog right here. Like we're in it. And yes, in the beginning, from the time I met him, he was like, I'm just not ever going to get married. I don't even think I should date you because you're the kind of girl that seems like she wants to get married. And I'm not the kind of person who's going to do that. So we just shouldn't even date. I think initially I took it almost like as a challenge. And then I was like, wait, I think he's kind of serious. I think he actually doesn't want to get married. And I always knew I wanted to have kids and I always knew I wanted to get married. And I, not to say that you can't do one without the other, but that was just not, I don't know, the image I had in my mind of the way this was going to go. And so in terms of, if your question is, how did I get him to change his mind? Is that your question?
Was it just a battle of attrition? Was this like, you just eroded him over? Like, what was the...
Maybe you should ask him. But I think ultimately, I don't know that you can change someone's mind. I actually had to get to a place where I was like, he told me that he didn't want to do this. And I'm making a deliberate decision that if I continue down this path, I have to either be okay with it or not. And I have to make a decision around it. And I will tell you, I'm sure it made me a very salty person. And he has said many times since then, he's like, the best thing I ever did. He's like, you became so much nicer as soon as I proposed. Cause I was kind of like, but I do think it teaches you, like that experience taught me a little bit of the idea of patience a little too. And if like, you know, that this is something that you want to invest in it, which I think is actually a similar analogy to what's happened in my career. Like, I think I really invested in my career. And so then when I got the chance to do this and to raise a little money and to start it, I think I had this like groundswell of people who were like rooting for me and this experience. And like, similarly with my personal relationship with my husband, I feel like we had done some of that work where we grew up together. And this part of our lives has been really beautiful because, not to say we haven't had our own ups and downs, but I think like the fact that we're able to work together, which is something I really never expected. That in and of itself, I think is a pretty big testament to our relationship. Never mind the 3 children, by the way.
We have That's 3 kids. It is a lot. It is a lot.
It is a lot. I think anytime you have shared responsibility with someone, it's hard. You have your own opinions about the way you want it to go. I mean, you have a co-founder. I don't have a co-founder. That seems hard.
Yeah, it's a similar, right? It's a marriage in a different way, especially if you really are in it for the long haul. You know, we've been working together now. We've known each other for close to 20 years and we've been working together for 12, right? So
it's a marriage.
Yeah. I am super impressed with everything you've accomplished, especially as I started to kind of dive into the research, and really appreciate you taking out the time. Wishing you continued success. You guys are going to keep killing it.
Thanks, Connor. And honestly, thanks for always participating in my, like, being a thought partner, but also like the Clean Beauty Summer School, like every time I learn something.
I'm glad to hear it.
You've been super generous.
I love it. I'm like you. I love that stuff. All right. Bye, Amy.
Thanks.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.